Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, choosing the common good. The bishops of England and Wales publish a new document proposing a shared vision for Britain as voters prepare for a May general election. Resurrection in El Salvador. The lasting legacy of Archbishop Oscar Romero comes to life in a musical marking the 30th anniversary of his assassination. And Gypsy Ministry is at the heart of a three-day meeting here in the Vatican. Where there is no vision, the people perish. With that quote from Proverbs 29, the Catholic bishops of England and Wales have launched a new publication presenting principles of the Church's social teaching as an essential contribution to the vision of a healthy British society. As the nation heads towards a general election, the bishops say this shared vision must look beyond the details of party politics. In fact, they argue the broad economic and social problems facing the country cannot just be left to government to solve, but must be the shared responsibility of all. The new document was presented at a press conference in London on Wednesday by the President and Vice President of the Bishops' Conference, Archbishops Vincent Nicholls of Westminster and Peter Smith of Cardiff. Just ahead of the launch, I spoke to Archbishop Nicholls to find out more about the message contained in the document entitled Choosing the Common Good.
The essential message is that we wish to say and illustrate and build on the fact that in this country there are many reasons to be hopeful. It calls upon the whole of society to recognise the depth of generosity and compassion and goodwill that is in the English character, and to try and bring that to the surface more consistently. It comes and is seen evidently in times of crisis, either internationally or locally, but then sometimes we sink back and it fails to give a character to the culture in which we live. And in this document, we try to offer some of the language and the thought patterns of Catholic social teaching around the common good, around the concept of integral human development, and to say this can give a framework for our reflection and debate. And then also we say, but action is required, and the action that's required is that we live by the best in our character. In other words, we exercise some of those classic virtues of justice and of courage and of right judgment or prudence and of temperance. And it's the exercise of the virtues that will help to recreate in our society the level of trust that is necessary for effective politics. And that trust has been eroded somewhat in recent years.
As you say, there is a very serious problem, or at least there is an image problem anyway, because as you say, there is a certain view of broken Britain which seems to be quite pervasive today. How do you contrast that, first of all, and begin to rebuild this trust that you're talking about?
Well, I don't accept the term broken Britain. I don't think there is evidence that Britain is broken. If we wish to develop an analogy along that lines, then I would say, in the body of Britain, perhaps some of the arteries are a bit clogged, are a bit furred up. And therefore, the faith in one another, the trust, the level of generosity and spontaneity is all a bit slowed down and clogged down a bit. So what do you do in those circumstances? You try and get some more exercise and clear those arteries so that what is there can flow. And I think that exercise that we need is the willingness on everybody's part to really put their best foot forward and to build deliberately and systematically on a vision of a common good and on a life that is characterized by those virtues. And if everybody chooses to do that, then I think we have the context in which political parties can really do their stuff as well.
Who is this message mainly aimed at? Is it the Catholic voters? Is it the politicians?
Well, it's a message which is aimed, as the photograph on the cover suggests, to anyone who is prepared to listen. I hope this will find some resonance in people's lives. And if it does, then I think we do well to look to the parties to see how they might respond. Obviously, it's directed to Catholics because it draws on Catholic social teaching. But our experience here is that Catholic social teaching, when carefully presented, is something that others find very helpful as well. And so we offer this document widely, but certainly to the Catholics in these lands.
Catholic social teaching is often called the church's best kept secret, isn't it? You're really claiming that it has pretty much all the answers to society's problems, aren't you, in this message?
No, this message doesn't suggest particular solutions to many of the problems. In fact, it highlights some of the problems and acknowledges their difficulty. It is very much for those who exercise political leadership and therefore political power to come up with the solutions. But what we're trying to do here is highlight some of the key themes that are in the background, that are, if you like, fundamental to the shaping of a vision, out of which then those with political leadership have to fashion realistic responses and solutions. So I think we're very clear that the role of the church is to offer insight, is to offer a vision. But it's not one of proposing particular solutions to the problems of a society at any one time.
And yet it mentions many areas of concern for the church, from the right to life to poverty, immigration, ecology, marriage and family life. How do you go about the process, or how did you manage to, if you like, condense these many issues into one document?
Well, I think if you look at the choice that has been made of the more specific issues, you will see that they all relate directly to that quality of life between people. So they all are related to the health of a society. It's the economy that has to generate its wealth. It's the political processes that have to govern its power. But the health of a society depends on how people live together, how they relate together, and all of those specific things are precisely about that. They're about the responsibility for life itself. They're about responsibility to the elderly and the poor. They're about the importance of marriage and family as the basic place in which people learn to build what we call social capital. It's about the environment, because that's an intensely human issue, the human ecology as well as the natural economy. And of course, it's about the role of faith communities in a pluralist society like ours.
I imagine this is quite likely to be seen as something of a condemnation, though, of politicians and bankers and the failure of other institutions. Is there something of that in this?
Well, clearly, we do face a situation in which public trust has been shaken. But we admit in this document that this is an experience of the Catholic Church, too. And we know what it's like when trust is betrayed. We know how much damage that does, and we know something of the hard work that is needed to rebuild that trust. So we're not offering cheap condemnations, because this is something within our own experience, and it's difficult and it's demanding, but it is possible. And I hope in this document we put forward some of the vision and some of the practical steps that everybody might take in order to rebuild trust. Choosing the common good is an invitation to everybody in our society to think about how they live. It's also perhaps about how they vote. But first of all, choosing the common good is the invitation we offer to people about their way of life.
You're looking ahead to the forthcoming election. Do you think there is such a thing as a Catholic vote in Britain today?
No. I think Catholics vote according to their convictions on the agendas that are put forward by the different parties. We have never in this country had any tradition of aligning Catholic votes with a particular party. We want to support Christians and Catholics in every party, in all of the main parties, and ensure them that we engage seriously with them, and we would expect a serious engagement back. Thank you.
And my thanks there to Archbishop Vincent Nicholls of Westminster, President of the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales. National directors of Catholic agencies providing pastoral care for gypsies in Europe concluded a meeting in the Vatican on Thursday. The three-day event was organised by the Pontifical Council for Pastoral Care of Migrants and Itinerant Peoples, looking at ways in which the Church has sometimes added to the sufferings and solitude of these nomadic peoples. Among the speakers at the meeting was Martina Liebsch, International Policy Director and Head of Migration with Caritas Internationalis. She talked to my colleague Lydia O'Kane about the aims of the conference and about the work now being done to tackle discrimination against gypsies and travellers.
I think, first of all, to create visibility as well for the work of Caritas, in the specific case Caritas in Europe. So we have Caritases in different countries like in Italy, Spain, Slovakia, Czech Republic, Bulgaria, who work on the issue. Secondly, to provide a testimony about what they do, and one part is on the, let's say, the local level. There are quite a lot of education initiatives, so it seems to be that the key message, at least what I hear from them, is work with youngsters from the Roma people. So I think that's the second level. The third level is also to draw some similarities from the area of migration, and there is an overlapping because some of the Roma people are migrants as well. So I think it's probably highlighting that the challenges for integration for Roma are not that far away from those of migrant people. But what I also, in the preparation of this conference, realized the shocking reality of Roma people, and they add up a lot of, how to say, stigma. So they are Roma, they are migrants sometimes, they are often unemployed, live in poverty. If you add that many of them, of course, are women, children, vulnerable, so they have really a heavy, heavy burden to carry. That was one part, and the second part of the intervention as well was to show that through networking among different organizations, but also to cooperation with the European level, you can achieve something. Many people have said it here, not only me, it's a process which goes in small steps. But it's quite, I think, a success that the European Council has produced or took note of some guiding principles for the work with Roma within the European institutions, and I consider that as quite a success.
You mentioned the role of education, and you see a lot of the Roma, and you see them on the streets, you see them on the trains. How difficult is it? I mean, do the Roma want to be included in education? Is it hard to get them themselves to want to streamline themselves into education? Or is it just a case of forming the policies and the projects to get them involved?
Well, not being a specialist on the issue, I would really not dare to say that they don't want to be involved. But of course, they have a very specific living condition. They have experienced marginalization and exclusion. So it does not surprise me that probably their confidence in institutions, the ones we consider as normal, is not very high. The Fundamental Rights Agency found out through a recent survey, the European Fundamental Rights Agency, that the confidence, for example, in police, just as another example, that they would help them in case of, you know, racist activities towards the Roma is really low. So I would not really dare to say that they don't want. I think it's probably more an issue how we design our education around and for Roma children. What I learned from the experiences from one project, which was done 3 years ago, finished 3 years ago with different Caritas organizations, is that they try to integrate formal learning with non-formal learning and informal activities. So it's more a package which you have to offer and not just expect that people would just enter the mainstream schools. That's one issue. And the other issue which I learned as well is that I think it was in Czech Republic, many children went into special schools, so they were segregated from the very beginning, which of course makes also then difficult to build up the trust to be part of the mainstream education.
It's a very difficult subject to deal with, the subject of discrimination. To tackle that, it's a daunting prospect, really, isn't it?
It is very difficult, and I think coming from the area of migration, you know that, again, this is a battle you don't win forever, if I may use the term battle. I think if I look at certain realities in some countries, sometimes you would say the situation has not improved, but got worse. If you look at nationalism, at, you know, speak against migrants, also forms of subtle discrimination. I think you have to be constantly putting the finger in the wound on one hand, so also at the political level. I think that's why it's good that, for example, at the European level, you have this fundamental rights agencies who provide a lot of resources where you can, apart from your own perception, say, well, there's the evidence for what we perceive. And I think the other issue is that you, of course, at local level, and that's what we have learned in many other circumstances, you just don't work in isolation, but you always work at a community level. So I remember one of the projects I mentioned in my presentation, it was really to work within the community and make the links between, let's say, the majority in that specific case of Roma and the minority, and let them identify, for example, common interests, common worries.
A bishop may die, but God's church, which is the people, will never perish. The prophetic words of Archbishop Oscar Arnulfo Romero just a few weeks before his death on March 24, 1980. The Archbishop of San Salvador, known simply as Monsignor, was shot dead as he said Mass in the simple chapel of the hospital where he chose to live. When he was appointed to the job 3 years earlier, he was considered a quiet, conservative candidate, a man who could strengthen relations between the government, the military, and the church in the face of escalating civil strife and political repression. But less than a month after taking office, Romero found himself burying a Jesuit priest and friend who'd been assassinated for helping poor communities organize themselves to assert their rights. It was a transforming moment as the new archbishop realized he could not be faithful to the gospel message without standing on the side of the poor and oppressed. Increasingly, he began speaking out against the torture and killings perpetrated by government-backed militias that were supported logistically and financially by the US administration. The day before his assassination, Romero openly challenged the military leadership in a homily broadcast across the country, saying no soldier is obliged to obey an order that is contrary to the will of God. Words he knew were most likely to cost him his life.
If they kill me, I will rise again in the people of El Salvador.
3 decades on from his death, Romero is remembered and revered by many as the voice of the voiceless, an inspirational figure for all who struggle to uphold the gospel values of equality, justice, and peace. In Britain, his legacy is now being celebrated through a musical, which made its London premiere in September 2009 and is now being staged by schools and other drama groups, with proceeds going to support CAFOD development projects in El Salvador.
Church of God, which is the people, will never die, will never die, will never die, will never die.
It caught me emotionally, and that to me was one of the first things I noticed about it. And then I did my own research into the story of Oscar Romero, and it became obvious to me that this was a story that was worth representing and worth remembering.
Audrey Tang is artistic director of Click Productions and the producer of Romero the Musical. She and author Liam Bowris sat down with Jesuit Communications Officer Jed Clapson to talk about the staging of this show as a way of making Romero's legacy come alive for young people today.
In composing, it seemed to happen quite quickly. Once I got a clear picture with my co-writer, George Daly, of the story and of the characters involved, I did more research in the early years of 1982 over in Ireland. I met at least three people there who knew Romero, or also met his one of his biographers. And so I got a much clearer picture of the kind of style of music I ought to write for the different characters. That did help.
So, Audrey, what was your feeling when you heard about this particular project?
I listened to the music, first of all, and actually something Liam hasn't added on there was he wrote it in the style of a mass, which I thought was absolutely beautiful. And one of the things that struck me was the motifs that kept coming back. And because I have a picture of things when I hear music, because years of dancing, you learn to interpret in that way. There were moments when I was following the script, hearing the music, and I just thought, oh, it'd be so nice if this character's tune came back, and there it was. And so moments like that just really, it was very emotional. It's not just him in terms of the whole story. What we wanted to pull out was characters such as Rutilio, Jean Donovan, Maria Gomez, some of the characters who were, Maria was a school teacher, Jean Donovan a human rights worker, again, all of them in a situation that they didn't choose for themselves necessarily in terms of the politics, but they were the ordinary folk, and the fact that Romero represented them was quite incredible and very inspirational. You just don't see that sort of story anymore. What I liked was that it was just real human life that was being portrayed there, and that was the most important part for us.
Now, it was staged recently in London, originally in Worth, and it's been to a few schools since then. Does it change as per the audience, the performers who are staging it?
I think for us, it was a change because we took it on about 30 years later, really. It's been that sort of length of time. Also, I work with a very good choreographer, and because I've got a dance background as well, I think we put a lot of dance aspects into it, which perhaps wouldn't have been in a straight, almost concert mass type production. I know that previous productions have used a lot of slides, but what we wanted to do was actually stage some of those ideas artistically and recreate them in dance, recreate them in costume. For example, in one of the numbers, The Death of Father Ortiz, there would have been the lighting showing the slideshow and the character probably just, I think, very black boxy, walking on stage, just being killed. What we wanted to do is just bring out more of the emotion, and we had a Venetian carnival concept for all of the deaths that we built upon. So by the time we got to Father Ortiz, who was near the last one to be killed, we actually had his costume covered in hooks, and we attached red ribbons to them and pulled out the ribbons. And as the deaths had all occurred, we'd probably done stage three death numbers. When Romero died, we literally just had one gunshot and that was it. And that was the contrast we wanted to put in, that that was the reality of the situation, and that was the loss. The difference there was just in terms of the artistic interpretation and what we wanted to put across while still remaining true to the story.
What ultimate messages do you feel that the story and the musical project, Liam?
Well, in 82, it finishes with the Church of God, which is the people will never die. At that time, it looked very bleak in El Salvador and for several decades since. And now, perhaps something is happening that is much more positive. The new president praying at Romero's tomb before he took office, quite remarkable. So perhaps his saying, Romero saying that if they kill me, I will rise in the people of El Salvador, is finally coming through. He's been already called a saint, San Romero of the Americas.
What about the future of Romero the musical, because there are resources now available on the internet, aren't there?
There is on romerothemusical.com a full digital DIY pack. It basically enables you to download all you need to stage the musical yourself. You don't get a stage crew or actors, but almost practically everything else, the script, London script as well, and backing tracks and the guide tracks and the libretto. Originally, I was going to have that free, but then it seemed much more reasonable if people paid for it, but the money went to El Salvador in development projects. So that's what it is. All the proceeds go to El Salvador.
But it's not just aimed at schools only. It can be for any group who would like to put on the musical themselves. And it's just a case of, here is something slightly different for you. It can be done on a big stage. It can be done just as a concert with, say, five people. But it's something different, and it's telling a very significant story. And that's really what we want it to be able to have living onwards. In the same ways, I think Romero himself wouldn't have expected a musical to be written about him. But the fact that his story is so inspirational and so moving, and that we hope that other people will at least find that side of things if they stage it themselves, and then it can go to support the work he started, I think that's quite a wonderful thing to be part of.
My thanks there to author Liam Bowres and producer Audrey Tang, talking to the Jesuit Communications Officer in the UK, Jed Clapson. Once again, all the details and resources for staging the musical can be found online at www.romerothemusical.com. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English programme for today. Join us again at this same time tomorrow if you can, or find us on the internet, www.vaticanradio.org/English. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.